Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter of Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, myself and, of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. I think the first thing we've got to talk to our audience about on this one, Leslie Ann, is the fact that we've come back to re-record the start because we got grounded on the launch pad. I mean, Leslie Ann, what did you do?
Not sure, really. Thanks very much to our producer, Sam, who always manages to pull it out of the bag at the last minute. But I think, you know, some of these platforms update themselves. They try new tricks.
The thing
they do wrong is that they don't let their users know.
Oh.
And if only they would put out a tweet or put something up on somewhere to let us know that they're adapting their services so that we could adapt as they go along.
Absolutely. Well, of course, I'm not blaming you, Miss Jones. That was just a bit of a joke. In fact, there's a vicious rumour going round that in order to upgrade the services that we use, they introduced camera technology, and that the first time the camera copped my ugly mug, it blew up. And, you know, I thought it was a very cruel way of trying to tell me that my better years are behind me. However, as you quite rightly say, Sam, the techo magician, got involved, and now, fortunately, we're up and running, and the rest of this podcast, Life on Planet Porky, will now unfold in front of you.
Yeah, very good. I don't think it's anything to do with your mug, by the way, because we're used to seeing that on television. You know, we all steal ourselves before you come on screen, Mike.
Yes,
we know what we're dealing with.
It's true. Talking about that, by the way, and I'm going to blow my own trumpet now, I was invited onto the Jeremy Vine on 5 show just yesterday morning, actually. And it was because they had all their normal guests on, but all their normal guests put the opening of pubs right to the back of the list of priorities, you know, children back at school, non-essential shops, all that kind of stuff, swimming pools, leisure centres. And I went on and once again defended the pub trade and said, I think pubs are so vital to life in this country, health and wealth. I want them to be a priority. And I got a fantastic response, both positively and negatively. It is a really big argument about when we open our pubs again.
Of course it is, because they are enclosed spaces. But I think there is some move now to reopen first the ones with outdoor spaces and with a bit of a garden. I know there aren't very many of those in London, but there are pubs we know and love where you can stand outside, for example. Say like the French in Soho, places like that.
Yes, I know.
So perhaps they will reopen those kind of pubs first. I don't think you're going to have to wait too long now, Mike.
Yeah. What did John Lennon say? Sitting in an English garden waiting for the sun. If the sun don't come, you get a tan from standing in the English rain. That's the only problem. You can't guarantee any weather in this country in spring. But I know what you mean. I hate, by the way, those pubs where you stand outside and you have to put your glass on the window ledge and then it falls off because the window ledge is at an angle. I mean, that drives me mad. That's why I prefer going into pubs.
I think the main reason a lot of people took to standing outside was so that they could smoke a cigarette at the same time.
It's true. It's absolutely true. Now, what would a Planet Porky podcast be, Miss Jones, without a reference to Mr. John Lennon? In fact,
you just made one because you sang the song, but you did
call him
John Evans, by the way. Did you know?
No. John Lennon. That must have been a warp of the intercontinental airwaves upon which
Freudian slip, we work.
Yeah. No, what I was going to say is that it's actually not John Lennon we can talk about in the pod today. Yoko Ono is 88 years of age. She is a woman of great fascination to me, Leslie Ann. She still lives in I don't know how many apartments they've got, but they've got more than one apartment in the Dakota, probably the darkest and most satanic looking building in the whole of New York on the edge of Central Park. And ever since John Lennon was killed in 1980, she's lived in that place on her own. I mean, isn't that all a bit sort of mysterious?
No, I don't think so. I think she lived there. Obviously, she did live there with Sean, her son, for quite some years. For all I know, he may still live in there. I think John and Yoko owned 5 apartments in the Dakota at one time.
Five, yeah.
It's very interesting because that building, when it was built in the 1800s, that was the furthest reaches of Manhattan. So it was in the sticks.
Yes.
It wasn't in the city, whereas now we tend to think of that as part of the city of New York.
Yes.
But in those days, it was a very far-flung place, much as Crystal Palace was, let's say, from the city of London. And that would have been a stagecoach ride or an outride on horses and so on.
Yes,
and
it would.
And, of course, it was named after the state of Dakota.
Yeah.
And you've been there. It's got sort of weird, it's got a moat around it, guarded by stone dragons and all kinds of weird creatures and so on. It does look very gothic and dark.
Oh,
but
very
inside,
gothic.
But inside the apartments, they're very luxurious.
Very luxurious indeed. A lady called Connie Chung used to live there. I don't need to remember it. It's from decades ago now. But she was America's morning breakfast, champion host. And she lived there. I tell you what I do know about it, because I read some information on the Dakota once. You're right, it was built, I think, in the 1800s. Did you know that between each floor, so between the ceiling of one apartment to the floor of the apartment above it, there is 6 feet of sand, because they are so completely soundproofed, and they did it in those days with sand because they didn't have anything else. And so they had to make it such a strongly monolithic building to hold the weight of the sand.
Oh, that's fantastic, because it's also a great fire deterrent, sand, isn't it?
Yeah, is it? Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
The only apartment I've ever been into in the Dakota is Lauren Bacall's.
Wow.
I met her on a film set years ago. I was sent to do an interview with her.
Yeah.
And she was fierce. She didn't like people, let alone other women. She just didn't like other people at all. But we got on, actually. We struck a spark. And she said to me, next time you're in New York, give me a call. Here's my number. And come up and see me sometime and have tea.
That's fantastic. And you went into the Dakota and saw what's it like inside then?
All the apartments are different, but hers was very traditional with wood paneled walls and very thick carpet and sort of quite ancient furniture, really. There was nothing cool and trendy about it, as you'd expect. But the views over the park, Central Park, were magnificent.
I was going to say, I can't even remember there being windows in the Dakota. It looks so dark and castle-like, but it's got great expansive windows and views, has it?
Oh, yeah, right the way over the park, which is the best view to have, isn't it? It's like staying in the Essex House. You've stayed there.
Oh, I love the Essex House. I always try and stay there and always ask for a room at the front, or a suite, I should say, at the front. That thing about five apartments, I mean, that's not unusual amongst the very wealthy in New York. And usually women have one apartment dedicated solely to keeping their fur coats at a low temperature throughout the summer to wear again in the bitterly cold Manhattan winters.
Oh, yeah. Yoko had, in one of the lower apartments, she had specially designed fridges, refrigerators, for her fur coats. But there came a time, in New York especially, when you couldn't be seen out on the streets of New York in the 80s, when the PETA people sort of came to the fore, the animal protection rights people, and they would come along and chuck buckets of blood and animal guts all over you, which I always thought was a bit weird, because if you're protecting animals, why would you throw animal guts all over a human?
Yes, no, I totally agree. I always found that very odd indeed. I think it's gone the other way a bit now, Last time I was there, I saw some women in fur coats and I made an inquiry and they said that's all sort of gone now. And anyway, apparently the imitation fur these days is so good that you can't tell the difference between that and the real stuff anyway.
A lot of it is, yeah. I personally wouldn't wear a real fur coat. I've got a couple of faux fur coats that I do bring out in the coldest winters.
Yes.
I've also got a sheepskin coat, which sometimes when I reach to put it on, I think, should I really be wearing this? But on the other hand, it's an old one. I've had it a long time. Would it be worse to throw it away? I feel like I'm kind of respecting the sheep who donated its wool to make that. So,
sure. I had a sheepskin coat made by a Polish tailor in Brooklyn. I went over there with Phil Finn, my colleague, and we just went over there and we just got them made. and they're just magnificent because they were built to protect you from a like a minus 25 crosswind in Manhattan, you know. And when I got back to this country, I never wore it. It was never cold enough to be able to wear, and it's huge. It was like walking around with a, you know, like a sort of a wardrobe on you. But anyway, there we go. Now, Miss Jones, I'm getting plagued by some nutter. Not me, I should imagine thousands of people are getting played. The phone rings, right, and it's an 0203 number, which actually is like an 0207 number. So you think, oh, that's somebody in an office ringing me from, you know, some company or studio or something like that. And you answer it, and then you get the most ridiculous, you know, American accent saying, you know, you have been served a summons to appear at your local county court by Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. We are seeking repayment of you. But before we proceed in this matter, you must ring us back on the following number. I mean, what a stupid scam. Does anybody think?
Were they American or Northern Irish?
Sorry?
Were they American or Northern
yes,
Irish?
Yes, they're Americans, Miss Jones. You don't have much view for my accents around the world, do you?
Well, you turned into Ian Paisley halfway through that.
Ian Paisley, how dare you? But do you think anybody would be thick enough to listen to this pre-recorded message? Because that's what it is. And then say, oh dear, somebody wants to sue me. I better ring back immediately.
May I ask, was this on a mobile or on a landline?
It came onto my mobile.
So the rule of thumb is, if you have a mobile, you've got people in your phone who you recognise, their name comes up, or you know the number, whatever. If a number comes up that you don't know, just don't answer it.
Yeah, but you see, that's okay. But, you know, recently I did a small slot on Piers's show, Good Morning Britain, the show that you starred on, I think, a couple of weeks beforehand. And that came as a number I didn't recognise. But I answered it because I was intrigued. If I hadn't answered it, you know, I wouldn't have spoken to the producer at Good Morning Britain.
Okay, well, there's a lot of these scams going around at the moment. The one I'm getting every day, pretty much, is from TV licensing, except that they can't spell TV licensing. So that always is a red flag to me.
Yeah.
And then you just look at the email address that their email has been generated from.
Yes.
And it's always something that looks unofficial.
Yeah.
It's never .gov.uk or whatever. It's always got .se or some other thing on the end.
Sure.
So that's how you tell, is to check the email address.
Yeah.
And you can always see that it's a scam by doing that. Just delete it.
Yeah.
Don't, whatever you do, open it or answer it.
I mean, that might have a virus in it, mightn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's generally what they're doing it for, or to steal your money.
Well, why do they want to put a virus in your system? Just out of nastiness to wreck your system?
Well, no, they can control, they can gain access to your personal accounts,
really?
For example.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah, so all of that—that's how they steal your money out of your bank account.
Yeah, well, that's good advice. Well done, Miss Jones. You're protecting society. Now, what did you think when you heard that Harry and Meghan are going to spill all now to Oprah Winfrey? I've never got the Oprah Winfrey thing. I mean, you know, I've seen her on telly for years, like everybody else. I don't quite know why she's the queen of TV. I've seen better female interviewers. Joan Rivers was a much better interviewer than Oprah Winfrey. And, you know, other people like, you know, the legendary newspaper columnists in America. And I don't quite get Oprah Winfrey.
Okay, that's because you don't live in America. She's one of the most powerful, most influential people on earth.
Yes.
She's a black icon.
Yes,
that's
she is.
The key. She's black. She's self-made. Mm. She's the epitome of the American dream. She was raised by a poor single mother, started out with nothing, clawed her way to the top. She has not only her own TV series, but she has her own TV channel.
Yes,
she
that's
is
right, yeah.
all powerful. And if you want to achieve anything in America, you get on side of Oprah Winfrey.
Sure. And do you think it's right for Harry in particular? I mean, Meghan obviously has her own agenda in life now. And I think the interview is going to start with Meghan. And then all of a sudden, Harry slides into the chair and starts talking. Do you think that's, you know, does that make you shudder a little bit at the, you know, the reputation of the royal family perhaps about to take another knock?
Well, what I found odd in the first place was that she was a guest at their wedding,
yeah,
because they'd only met her once before. So weddings tend to be an occasion when you invite family, close friends,
yeah,
people who you maybe went to college with, who you haven't seen ever since, and you want to regroup and sort of bring your life back together full circle.
Yeah.
You don't tend to invite influential media people, do you, as guests, unless you've got an agenda.
Yes.
So I think there's been an agenda here from the start.
I think you're right.
In Meghan's head, not necessarily Harry's.
Yeah.
But I think what you have to do, which they haven't quite done yet,
yeah,
they're trying to have a foot in both camps. Hmm. So you've got to, if you want to leave the royal family, good luck, leave the royal family,
yeah,
leave behind your connections, go off and have another life, which they've kind of done. But now we're told they're moaning because he's going to be stripped of his military privileges and his, yeah, titles, and that they will no longer have their royal titles either because they're, yes, not working royals.
Yes.
So if you want to go out and be media personalities, close down the whole connection.
Hmm.
And then start again as something else. Don't try and be both. And I think that's why we're annoyed about it.
Yeah.
Because you know, they seem to be trying to have the best of both worlds.
I totally agree. Look, I'm not piling in on Meghan, but you've just made a very good point. Why was Oprah Winfrey at their wedding? Because she's already said she was surprised to get the invitation. She only briefly met Meghan once before. So, I, you know, I'm not piling in on Meghan, but she has had a clear agenda of the plan, you know, even before they got married, on how their life would pan out after they were married. And clearly Oprah Winfrey was part of it, wasn't she?
The interesting question, why did Oprah Winfrey accept the invitation? If she was confused by it, why am I being invited to this royal wedding?
Well,
I'd only met them once,
yeah, but
before.
She saw the great interview coming, didn't she, obviously?
I suppose so.
Yeah.
But that sort of puts her in the same box as them. It makes it all very cynical. That's not a reason to go to a wedding.
But except that Oprah Winfrey's job is to try and scoop up the most famous and important people in the world for her show and her TV channel. So, of course, she was going to go. I don't blame Oprah Winfrey under any circumstances. She is a great professional, as you say, you know, one of the world's most successful broadcasters. Of course she would go. It's Meghan that I think has to really try and explain to us in years to come, you know, how she formulated this plot for her life and Harry's after wedding. Talking about powerful and famous women, I was going to talk to you about Paris Hilton, who is 40. Is Paris Hilton, in fact, famous and powerful?
Well, she is. You know, she was years ago now, it is 2001. She,
yeah,
was proclaimed New York's leading It Girl, when we used to call people It Girls.
Yes.
But that's a long time ago now. She's a grown-up woman.
Yeah.
You might as well say, what's the point of any socialite? You know, she's the great-granddaughter of Conrad Hilton.
That's right.
Who founded Hilton Hotels.
Yep.
She became a DJ, a socialite. The thing that she was a fixture of tabloid journalism.
Yeah.
And that's why she came to matter, because the media made her matter.
Yes. Yeah,
so if she doesn't ultimately matter, then it's the media's fault.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Do you remember when actually you'd made it in life if you stayed in a Hilton hotel?
Yeah, I wouldn't stay in one for toffee now.
Well, this is what I mean. This is an amazing thing. The first time I got invited to some sort of dinner or lunch or something at the Hilton Hotel, Park Lane, I thought, bloody hell, I've arrived here. You know what I mean? And whenever I was sort of romancing a young lady from Fleet Street, you know, I could always impress her by saying, you know, I'm staying over at Hilton tonight. Would you like to join me? You know what I mean? I
thought, here we go.
What do you mean, here we go? What do you mean?
Have you been in that hotel recently, by the way? When, before lockdown, I mean.
No.
It's very 60s and very shabby.
Yeah, I know. It had a bar downstairs, which was like...
Oh, the Trader Vic's.
Yes, Trader Vic's, that's right, yeah. Is it Trader Vic's? They made it look like something out of Bally High or something. Is that the one?
Yeah, it was like that. And you got these cocktails that were in sort of halves of coconut or pineapple with a straw or something.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Yeah, but, oh, it was the done thing. And then over the years, of course, I realised, you know, when you went to, you know, good places, I went to, like, Sydney or something like that, the Hilton had become like a tourist hotel. And you know, you'd stay in, you know, the Shangri-La or something like that, something, you know, much, much classier. But you
they
know,
sold out, didn't they? Really, they went down market. And even the Hilton in New York, the Paris Hilton, the one she's named after,
yes,
was actually a very classy joint. I used to enjoy that place.
Okay. Yeah. But I know Hiltons, which really are just tourists. The Hilton in Cardiff, for instance, because we went to Cardiff a number of years, which I've mentioned to you, because the FA Cup final was switched there when they were rebuilding Wembley. Blimey, they, without any disrespect to the people of Cardiff, the Cardiff Inn Hilton was like a boozer, really, with a few rooms, you know, with no disrespect to the hotel or the people of Cardiff, who are fine people, drinking Brains beer. Listen, I tell you what, talking about hotels and things, we forgot to talk about the death of one of our heroes, Joe Allen, the man who actually founded the restaurant chain, Theatreland Restaurateur, who lit up both New York and London. And I've read a couple of reports of his life, and what a fascinating man he was. He had little ego. He used to sit at the bar sometimes in his restaurants, just sip drinks, and just listen to what the customers were saying about, you know, his restaurant and the food he was giving them.
Well, it's very interesting, isn't it, that everyone listening would think Joe Allen in Covent Garden. But of course, the Joe Allen, the original on West 46th Street in the Theatre District in New York, Broadway's front room, that's the one he founded. And that's the bar he used to sit at listening. I found out recently, and I didn't know this, that the posters all around the walls of the restaurants, Joe Allen, were mostly of failed shows. Shows that hadn't lasted very long on Broadway or in the West End. Yes.
Why?
And they'd been taken off for whatever reason. It was just a tick of his, something that he liked.
Really? That is fascinating. I love Joe Allen. I loved it in its original location in Exeter Street, I think, wasn't it, in London?
Yeah, and I don't like the new one at all. It's very disappointing.
I haven't been there. I mean, we'd have gone there for lunch now and celebrated a Planet Porky spectacular or something, had we been allowed to go out in the last year. But that is definitely on the list of things to do, Miss Jones, when we get up and get going again. I will be disappointed if the checkered tablecloths and the burgers that aren't even on the menu. That was a strange thing, wasn't it? You could order any burger you wanted, but they never appeared on the menu.
You could always order off menu. That was one of the attractions of Joe Allen. But I mean, it still has this new location, which is just off the Strand, as was the Exeter Street one.
Yeah.
It still has the brick interior walls, the show posters, the checked tablecloth, all of that. But it's not spacious. It's really quite cramped. It's got a sort of gallery bit that you sit on. It's got a front bit where, which is like Siberia.
Yes.
You don't want to sit there, like that bit in the ivy. And then it's got a sort of inner sanctum, but there's no bar area where you can sit anymore.
Oh, that's no good. It's no good to me.
Yeah, it's
the great joy of the old Joe Allen was meeting somebody there. I'd always get there 10 or 15 minutes early because I'm a gentleman. I wouldn't let a woman walk into a restaurant and feel, you know, abandoned, you know what I mean? And I'd sit at the bar and have at least two large gin and tonics to steel my nerves, awaiting for my my dining partner, and always to slip the head waiter a 20 quid note to make sure I got the sort of table I wanted. I hated those tables right next to the bar. I always wanted to be on the other side of the wall. You know what I mean?
In the inner sanctum, which they've tried to recreate in this new one, but it's not the same because it's too small.
Right. Well, that doesn't sound too good.
And I'll tell you what happened to me and Joe Allen. By
the way, yes.
Years ago, somebody we both know, who I'm not going to name because he'll probably come out and sue me, Mickey Finned my drink in Joe Allen.
No.
Seriously.
What, trying to take advantage of you?
Absolutely.
And did they have a hotel room booked nearby?
No idea. I passed out. I went to the ladies, didn't feel well.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, what's happened here? You know, I've only had a couple of glasses of wine. What's going on? So I went off to the ladies, passed out in the cubicle.
Yeah.
And our very dear mutual friend, Mr. Tavernick, realised that something had gone wrong because I think I was supposed to go off and meet him at 4 o'clock or something.
Yeah.
And I hadn't turned up, which was unlike me. And of course, in those days, we had no mobile phones.
No.
We couldn't call ahead.
No.
But he knew that I was having lunch with this person in Joe Allen.
Yeah.
So he came down there and he insisted to the staff that they look in the ladies. And of course, there I was, passed out in the loo.
Cool, you'd been there a few hours.
Yeah.
You could have died.
I could have died.
Seriously, you could have died. That's a terrible story. Well, Miss Jones, you must take more care in future.
I'll tell you, it was off air. You'll be horrified.
Yeah. But obviously, it's not your fault if somebody slips something into your drink. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Once again, I wish to apologise for the late launch of this particular podcast. That's down to some technical problems. I take full responsibility as I'm supposed to be chief mechanic and engineer. But we're rescued by our techno genius, Sam, and Miss Jones, I have to say, you yourself showed great, great fortitude in getting over the problem.
Well, do you know what crossed my mind? I was watching the landing of the module on Mars.
Yes,
and I was wondering whether it had shaken up our podcast a bit.
Yeah, I did. Do you know what? You're so right. I was watching that as well. And I couldn't make out whether the pictures of the craft landing with the parachute was simulated or they were real pictures taken from the mother craft above. Could you?
It all looked a bit surreal, didn't it?
Like, yeah, it did.
Like they used to say, did we ever go to the moon? Yeah. Or was this faked in the desert somewhere Midwest America? It didn't quite look real, but I'm sure it is. They would be outed as soon as that. If
I just couldn't make out if they're real pictures or simulated, but they're definitely there. I saw all the celebrations in the control room, you know, ground control to Major Tom and all that. And actually, anything which's got the word Mars in it must bring back memories of your great friend and rock star, David Bowie, because a lot of his life was consumed by his interest in Mars, wasn't it?
Yeah, there were quite a lot of references to him and to life on Mars on social media last night.
Yeah,
but,
of course.
It is fascinating that people keep saying, we have arrived on Mars, we have gone to Mars. We haven't. No humans have gone.
No. Well, I don't think you could, because if you set foot on Mars, you'd just burn up, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I suppose.
But, I think.
I mean, it's not we in that case, is it? It's a bit of technology that's gone to Mars, but it's not humans.
Well, it's we to the extent that we can now communicate with the surface of Mars because they're sending probes into it, if you see what I mean. And then the probes are sending back messages to Earth saying what sort of minerals are there and all that kind of stuff. So, but you're absolutely right. Did you ever see that film with Matt Damon of him being stranded on Mars?
I bought that for my dad, actually, a DVD of it. And I was going to watch it with him, but we were both too scared to watch it.
Well, I thought it was rubbish. I watched it. It was rubbish because this giant storm hit Mars and they all scrabbled back into the spaceship and took off, leaving Matt Damon on the surface of Mars, OK? But it was so ridiculous because the storm was so strong, it was blowing buildings away, but it didn't blow the rocket over. You know, it was... honestly, the special effects were not up to standard. It looked ridiculous. And then as the plot unfolded, where he managed to, you know, self-survive on Mars. And the other thing was that they were supposed to have a tracker for him and they had a camera watching his movements on the surface. It didn't make sense. But anyway, look, let's forget about that. We talked a few minutes ago, Leslie Ann, about Joe Allen, our favourite restaurant, about getting out to restaurants again when, you know, the shutters come up and we can all start living our life as normal. And I was delighted to read that there's now going to be a worldwide ban on foie gras. You know, the pâté that's produced in the most disgusting and horrible circumstances. I don't know how any civilised world can allow that to go on even now.
It is a really disgusting practice. It's, for anyone who doesn't know, they force feed ducks and geese to enlarge their livers.
Yeah.
And then they make the foie gras out of the livers, these enlarged livers. Production of it was banned in Brussels a few years ago, the capital of Europe, let's say.
Yes.
It's a hideously cruel industry. Mm. To torture animals in this way, who would want to eat that? I have to say that I never have.
Oh, it would choke in my throat. A, I would never order it, but B, if I suddenly found I was eating it, how could any human being justifiably say, well, it's worth torturing animals like that to give me a nice place of liver pate?
It's interesting, though, that some people who refuse foie gras, for example, would think nothing of eating a veal steak, which is equally cruel to the animals.
Is it? I've never had a veal steak, I must admit.
Veal, you know, the baby calf is born.
Yes.
It's kept in complete darkness. It never sees daylight.
Oh, that's terrible.
Because, well, the whole point of it is to preserve the whiteness of the meat.
Is it?
Oh, so it never sees daylight. That's the reason. So its blood system doesn't develop the same as a cow who would see the light of day.
Golly, that's awful.
And they eat them when they're very small. So, you know, if you like veal, think twice. about eating that.
I will never eat veal again. I have to admit, I've eaten veal in breadcrumbs. Do they call them veal scallops or something?
Or Wiener Schnitzel.
Wiener Schnitzel. But that's only been at like places where I've been to buffets, you know what I mean? And you sort of finger food and all that kind of stuff. But I didn't realise the extent to which the cruelty goes on. Now, I'm going to hum something to you, Miss Jones. And because I perfectly replicate musical sound. You can tell me what it is. I'm going to sing it. I'm not going to hum it, okay? I'm giving her good vibrations. She's giving me good citations. Ba, 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 good vibration. Now, you can guess what that is, obviously. It's good vibrations.
Okay, the Beach Boys, February 1966. That was a hit.
Well, that's why I'm humming it to you. In 1966, the first takes of the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations were recorded in L.A., but of course, there's a long story to this one, isn't there? Because this was the song, wasn't it, that was supposed to knock the Beatles off their perch as the biggest giants in the rock world of the 60s.
Well, they met their match, didn't they? The Beach Boys and the Beatles, they sort of met in the middle, outdoing each other, respecting each other's work.
Yeah.
And Pet Sounds, Sgt. Pepper, you know, a lot of people said there wasn't much in that.
Yeah.
But they upped their game because of each other.
Yes.
So I think that was a wonderful pairing in the charts.
Yes. No, I think it was. I didn't realise that they actually became friends and, like, Brian Wilson talked to the Beatles about their sort of so-called mocking version of California Girls by helping them write Back in the USSR.
Well, it was a sort of send-up of it, wasn't it,
yeah.
Really? But I met Dennis Wilson in the 80s.
Dennis?
Dennis was the drummer.
The drummer who jumped off a boat at Venice Beach and never surfaced. Am I right?
Well, he didn't jump. I think he kind of fell. He was a bit of an alcoholic. The love of his life was Christine McVie of Fleetwood Mac.
Really?
And he never got over their breakup. But he drank too much. He drugged too much.
Yeah.
He fell off his boat. And that was the end of him. But we did the last interview with him. I was there with Roger Scott, the world's favourite DJ from Capital Radio. And we did do what turned out to be the very last interview with Dennis. Yeah.
And did you do it on his boat or in some exotic location?
It was on Jones Beach. Sort of suburb of California,
Los Angeles,
I should say, California.
Near Santa Monica, in fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was very pleasant. He was a charming man. He made some cracking solo albums as well. They're worth digging.
The drummer, Dennis Wilson.
Dennis Wilson, yeah, good singer.
I thought the only talented member of the Wilson family was Brian. And I thought the reason that Brian
I think Brian thought that as well.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. I thought the reason why eventually he went mad was because he was under so much pressure to keep producing more records, more hit records, more records for more LPs. He just went bonkers because until he'd written it, the other guys were just sort of hanging around doing nothing.
He did go a bit berserk. And I went to see him at the Festival Hall not too many years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And he sat at the front of the stage at a keyboard.
Yeah.
But he didn't play it the entire gig. He just sang into his microphone, but he never once played the keys. It's a bit like going to see Amy Winehouse, who would come on stage with a white guitar strapped around her neck, but she wouldn't actually ever play the damn thing. And that made me think of, you know, Andrew Ridgeley and Wham, who used to prance around on stage with a guitar but never played it.
Yes.
I don't see the point.
I think I've seen Elvis Presley with a guitar, which he never played. Well, I haven't seen him live, obviously, but I've seen pictures of him. And I've seen Mick Jagger with a guitar, but you told me Mick Jagger can play the guitar.
Yeah, he can.
Yeah.
But he tends not to because he doesn't play it as well as the other guys. But
well,
you will see him get up and sort of strum something occasionally,
Yeah, but also he's moving around all the time, isn't he? So it wouldn't actually be very good for him to play a guitar.
You know my theory about Mick Jagger's face, by the way? You know it's all sort of...
rubbery.
A bit folded, isn't it? It all sort of hangs there.
A bit
sort of like one of those dogs.
Yes.
What's one of those dogs with all the sort of multiple
schnauzer?
Jowls?
A schnauzer?
I don't know. I'm not a dog.
I think it's a schnauzer. Yeah, I think it's a schnauzer.
Well, you know, all that jumping up and down, that loosens your collagen in your face.
Right.
So that could be the reason why it's all sort of hanging strangely. He ought to stop jumping up and down, that jumping Jack Flash.
Now, this is a fantastic theory. Listen up, folks. Miss Jones's theory on Mick Jagger's face. He jumps up and down too much, has been doing it for 50 years, and the collagen. Now, if you're saying collagen, isn't that an insinuation that he's actually sometimes put stuff into his face?
No, not at all, because we naturally produce collagen.
Oh, I see. I thought you meant that he might have been, you know, given himself a bit of the old skin straightener and it's all fallen down his face.
No. You produce collagen.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it's a I'm going to say subcutaneous, which is under the skin.
Wow.
It's an underlying substance that we produce naturally, which maintains the springiness in our skin. And once that starts to dislodge and move around, that's when we begin the aging process.
Oh, well, there you go then. Thank you very much for letting me know. Another thing that's going to happen when lockdown becomes lifted, Ms. Jones, is that we can all go shopping again if there's any shops left to go to. Have you seen this plan to build a hill at the end of Oxford Street to give people an added incentive to go there? And for £2.50, you can walk up the hill and get fantastic views across Hyde Park and Marble Arch and down Oxford Street. I mean, that's one of the weirdest sort of pro shopping plans I've ever heard.
I looked at the diary thinking it might be April the 1st when I read that.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those things you see in newspapers year after year and you think, really? Mm. Can that? That's got to be a joke. Why would that entice people back to Oxford Street? Surely they would only go there for one thing, shopping.
Yes.
Why would they want to go and stand on a hill and look at the park?
Yes. No, I totally agree. I can't figure it out. And like you, I thought, hang on, this can't be serious. But, you know, they've got to think of a way of getting people back. I mean, for instance, what's the incentive now from where you live or from where I live to take a 25-minute journey into central London, either by tube or overland train or whatever, you know, tram or something, and then to mingle with thousands of people on narrow pavements on Oxford Street, going in and out of shops. I'm sure people will be frightened to get involved in crowds like that in the future, no matter what happens with the vaccine. When, for instance, let me give you this great story about online shopping. So this week, I have what I would call spotlights in my house, because, for instance, if I'm working on my laptop, I've got a spotlight next to it, which focuses light on it. I've got a spotlight above my television. So if I'm watching my television in the evening, the only light's on is the spotlight above the television. And I've got them all around my house. Now, the thing is, they've got special bulbs, right? And they're bulbs with four fingers in them. And they've always been difficult to get hold of. I used to get them at B&Q, went down to my local B&Q, which is still open. They said, no, I'm sorry, mate. You'll only get those now online. They're very specialist bulbs. Do you know what? I ordered them. I didn't. My sister's got an Amazon account. I rang her up. She's in Bournemouth. She ordered them for me at 2 o'clock one afternoon this week. And by 11 o'clock the following morning, a pack of four bulbs arrived on my doorstep. It was just amazing. I mean, where is the Amazon warehouse? Where did the bulbs come from that they managed to access so easily? How do they find drivers who, at the drop of a hat, go out and deliver the bulbs to Mike Parry in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey?
Well, we are Amazon refuseniks in our household.
Right.
We've given up Amazon. They exploit workers. They fight unions. They,
you think so?
Yes, they work in very disturbing labour conditions in Chinese factories, for example, that manufacture all these electronics sold on Amazon.
Yeah.
They fight tax laws that would support local economies. They create excessive packaging waste.
Yeah.
And they treat their delivery service workers extremely poorly. They're all on 0 hours contracts, whatever they tell the press.
Yeah.
And it's very bad pay, long hours. They're not a worthy company. And it's time we all gave them up. I'm sorry about your light bulbs, but you can get them from somewhere else.
Well, that's very strong words, Ms. Jones. I agree with some of what you've said. But, you know, convenience is the thing that most people count about. Very few people think about the conditions in which companies work. You know,
I know they should.
I mean, you and I have had the conversation about the Uyghur situation in China. If I found clothes now produced there, I would not just not buy them. I'd start a campaign to stop them being imported into the country.
So it's the same thing with your light bulbs, because all those parts are coming from factories in places like China where workers are exploited.
Well, the light bulb actually says, it's stamped on it, made in China. So you're absolutely right in what you're saying there. However, it does give people a living in these hard times. So when the parcel arrived on the doorstep, bloke knocked on the door and I went to the door, he'd already gone. But he looked over his shoulder and said, are you Mike Parry? I said, yeah. I said, light bulbs. I said, oh, thank you very much. You know, I was shocked.
How did he know what was in them?
Sorry?
How did he know what was in the package?
Oh, he didn't. I don't think he said light bulbs. I'm sorry. I think he said, you know, I've got, you know, a package for you. I said, oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah. So anyway, I could then see from the front of my penthouse windows, down into the street. And this guy was driving an ordinary car. I mean, just an ordinary saloon car. But when he went back to his car and opened the back door, all these Amazon packages fell out. And then he picked them all up, put them back in. Then he opened the boot, and that was stuffed with Amazon packages. And he delivered two more in my street alone. I mean,
Let's hope all those packages that fell out weren't light bulbs that ended up
yes,
broken.
That's absolutely
the
right.
The thing is, they have this horrible thing where they are forced to deliver something like 250 parcels per hour.
Well,
and
I think that must be a day.
Target, they get money knocked off and stuff. It's awful.
Oh, well,
I think you ought to give up Amazon. That is a bad habit.
Well, I'm not a great one for buying online because I always feel that if you want to buy something that really suits you, you've got to look at it first. You know what I mean? I never buy clothes online because they never fit me, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
You don't wear light bulbs by any chance.
I certainly don't wear light bulbs. Although, funnily enough, we've just been talking about the Beach Boys, and it just reminded me. The only time I went to a concert at Wembley was when I was about 19 or 20. And I went with my mate and we hitchhiked down from Chester. And it was to see Elton John at Wembley. But the support group was the Beach Boys. And Mike Love of the Beach Boys was wearing a huge white coat with light bulbs screwed into it. I remember it now. Just thought I'd let you know that, Miss Jones.
Oh, he was obviously feeling enlightened that night.
He was feeling very enlightened. You're absolutely right. Now, Miss Jones, as a good Welsh girl, have you ever heard of a chap called Doug Mountjoy?
I don't think I have.
No, OK. I'm going to read you this little story because it's a great story. Doug Mountjoy, popular snooker player from the game's heyday, who delighted viewers with his ruffled shirt and enjoyed a late career. The reason I tell you this is that Doug Mountjoy was one of the boyos. He was a miner in a Welsh pit village mine till he was 34. Then he came out of the mine and he was the local amateur champion at the local, you know, working men's snooker club. And he became a professional and started winning titles. A fantastic story of a bloke who just changed his life. Can you imagine being a minor one day and a professional snooker player the next? Mining must have, and by the way, there used to be 400 pits in your home country of Wales, if not 4,000. And can you imagine how miserable the life of a miner must have been?
Well, I know all about this because my family were down the mines.
Wow.
So, yes. So five brothers and three of their sons became the Jones Boys, the professional footballing family. And my family twice produced the world's most expensive footballer. But all those uncles were all down the mines, had no previous experience of playing football, all came up into the light and all became professional footballers for English clubs.
It's
a similar story, isn't it?
Yeah. Isn't that a story worth writing?
We've got a website, jonesfamilyhistory.com. It's all on there.
Really?
Yes, my uncle, my great uncle, in fact, Uncle Bryn Jones, was sold by Wolverhampton Wanderers to Arsenal for the world's biggest transfer fee in 1939.
Wow.
And history repeated itself in the 60s when my uncle Cliff Jones went to Spurs from Swansea.
Yeah. Good God, that's amazing. Do you know what? How many times have I sat down, had lunch with you and talked Beatles and football and everything else? I've never heard that story before.
I thought you knew all this.
Well, you'll have to tell me all about it again next time we share that table of Thai food and bottles of white and red, Miss Jones. It says here, the son of a miner, Fred Mountjoy and his wife, Rose. The son of a miner. The miner was called Fred Mountjoy and his wife, Rose. Doug Mountjoy was born one of five children in Tir y Berth near Caerphilly. In 1942, he was brought up in Ebb Vale. That's quite famous, isn't it?
Ebb Vale, yes.
In Blaen o Gwent, OK? Yeah, see, yeah. I know all these Welsh expressions. after
they're,
leaving
they're
school,
actually names of places, yeah.
Yes, that's right. After leaving school, he worked in the local pit for, get this, £3 a week. At the age of 17, he had a lucky escape when a roof fell in and he was trapped underground for several hours. I mean, that's almost Victorian, isn't it? That sort of working conditions.
Oh, it is horrible. There was a place called Big Pit yeah. Not very far from Merthyr Tydfil, which was my father's hometown.
Right.
And they turned it into a kind of museum. So you could go down into Big Pit and get one of the little trains going through the tunnels.
Yeah.
In reality, you were only inches from the surface of the ground.
Yes.
But it terrified me, and I cried my eyes out thinking that my granddad had to go down the pit. He used to call it that hole.
Yeah.
And he used to say to his mother, "Don't send me down that hole today, please, again. I don't want to go down there." And he had to go down there every day. And I always think of my granddad sobbing.
Yeah.
He was such a tiny little man.
Yeah.
That, you know, the old miner's lamps, the brass lamps with the hook on.
The Davy lamp.
He would hook it on his belt, and he was so small, it would drag along the ground.
God.
And it's always broken my heart that my granddad had to do that.
Yeah. Golly, that is a touching story. And I totally agree. Well, Miss Jones, I'm afraid that we've come to the end of this podcast. We've got to move quickly, or I've got to move quickly, because we didn't get the arrangements right when we started this, and we've got to get it out to our adoring audience. So, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed for your versatility in us getting this done and finished. And a big thank you to all our audience out there for having the patience to wait for this particular podcast. We won't keep you waiting again, will we, Miss Jones?
We will not. And please keep the messages coming. Absolutely loving hearing from everybody on Twitter. And a few sort of invitations out to dinner and stuff like that coming in. So I've been quite enjoying that as well.
Well, I think we'll talk about that next time, because one of these days that sun is going to come over the hill. How many offers we'll take up is another story to be told next time. Everybody else, stay safe and bye for now. Do you remember when actually you'd made it in life if you stayed in a Hilton hotel?
Yeah, I wouldn't stay in one for toffee now.
Well, this is what I mean. This is an amazing thing. The first time I got invited to some sort of dinner or lunch or something at the Hilton Hotel, Park Lane, I thought, bloody hell, I've arrived here. You know what I mean? And whenever I was sort of romancing a young lady from Fleet Street, I could always impress her by saying, I'm staying over at Hilton tonight. Would you like to join me? You know what I mean? What do you mean, here we go? What do you mean?
Dear. Have you been in that hotel recently, by the way? When, before lockdown, I mean.
No.
It's very 60s and very shabby.
Yeah, I know. It had a bar downstairs, which was like...
Oh, the Trader Vic's.
Yes, Trader Vic's, that's right, yeah. Is it Trader Vic's? They made it look like something out of Bally High or something. Is that the one?
Yeah, it was like that. And you got these cocktails that were in sort of halves of coconut pineapple with a straw or something.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
What's one of those dogs with all the sort of
schnauzer?
Jowls?
A schnauzer?
I don't know, I'm not a dog.
I think it's a schnauzer, yeah, I think it's a schnauzer.
Well, you know, all that jumping up and down, that loosens your collagen in your face.
Right.
So that could be the reason why it's all sort of hanging strangely. He ought to stop jumping up and down, that jumping Jack Flash.
Now, what would a Planet Porky podcast be, Miss Jones, without a reference to Mr. John Lennon? In fact,
you just made one because you sang the song, but you did
call
him John Evans, by the way.